Wednesday, wherever you may be. I am Yada. We're here with Kirk and with Scott. How are you guys?
Great. Terrific. Thank you.
I'm doing wonderful. Thanks.
Good. Good. We're going to begin a very different journey today. We have thus far covered the first three chapters, one chapter twice, which would be the opening chapter of Observations for Our Time. And in these first three chapters, now we're as we begin the fourth here, just by way of summation, Proverbs 6 is where we began. And in Proverbs 6, God explained why it was so essential to hate. And it is it's probably the best perspective under which we could begin being observant in our time. Because today the prevailing message that is given to the world, that is proclaimed in every university in the West, that is proclaimed by everyone in the media without fail, and that is announced by virtually every politician, that being hateful is the worst thing a person can be. And God takes umbrage with that. He says, no, it's extremely important to hate. Because we ought to hate things like rape and rapists, pedophilia and pedophiles, mass murder and mass murderers. We ought to hate those who engage in the slave trade. We ought to despise terrorists. God does. And the thing that God hates the most is those who lie when speaking of who he is and what he is offering. That would be the religious individuals. And he goes through and he explains what it is that he hates, calling six of the seven things on his list, all seven an abomination, and six of the seven things that he literally despises. And as we go through it, the only institutions that meet the criterion that he laid out were religions and political schemes. And that specifically, only one individual, and he speaks of a specific individual that he hates, only one individual meets the profile that is presented in Proverbs 6. That's Shaul, the man who became known as Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, truly the founder of the Christian religion. Now, we moved from there to a universal condemnation of religion. That's found in the first book of Shemuel. It was originally written as one book, but what we now call the seventh chapter, where God provides not only an indictment against religion, but also a encouragement, saying that for those who forego and who disassociate from everything that is religious in nature, that for them is his promise to protect them. Moving on to the third chapter, we began to review what God had to say about human governance, about political schemes. And it is amazing how indicting God is of them. And it's important to know because in places like Israel and Israel, religion and politics are melded together as if they were one. That has been the case in the United States for most of its existence, and it still is to a large degree. And, of course, in the Islamic world, there is no difference between the government and the religion. They are one and the same. And so what God says is that religious leaders defraud their citizenry. The first thing that they will do is they will take their sons, they will craft weapons of war, and then they will deploy them. And then it says they will tax the people and rob the people of everything they hold dear. It is precisely what we witness in the entitlement, socialistic nature of government as we see it today, and it is no different really than the fascist feudal system that we saw play out throughout the influence of Roman Catholicism in Europe and in every Islamic country today. So with those three stories behind us, I wanted to present an accounting of of not just where God wants us to be, but how he is willing, because it's, you know, this expose that we're on, Observations for Our Time, has God universally in opposition to the two most pervasive of human establishments. Almost everyone is aligned with either a religious institution or a political one. Most people both. And so there would be a lot of consternation amongst most people to walk away from both religion and politics, to disassociate from them, and actually to be adverse to them. And so before we moved into the fifth chapter, which is now complete, and we will present it before too very long, the fifth chapter continues in the Proverbs, going to the fifth proverb, which, excuse me, the sixth proverb. I'm going to get this right here in a moment. You know, I'm sure my value to this program is every bit as much as I'm paid to participate in it. It is the seventh proverb. The opening chapter of Observations for Our Time chronicles what God had to say in the sixth. The seventh is a continuation of it, and that is where we're going to head after we consider the 91st Psalm. And we've taken this detour to the 91st Psalm for two reasons. One is very personal for me. This is the one place where, after having written, I think it's now 7,000 pages of material, I get personal. I'm going to, in just a moment, tell my own personal story, because Psalm 91 is intensely personal to me. But that personal story should also resonate with everyone who is listening, because just as Psalm 91 was written for me, it was also written for you. And in it, God pledges to do a number of things on behalf of those individuals who are willing to engage, to expose and condemn religion and politics. Now, here is Psalm 91. And I just want to put this in context. Where we're going next is we're going to return to God's assault against religion. The seventh proverb not only shows how the adversary, Satan, in the guise of a whore, a prostitute, has used religion to lure the ignorant and the irrational, the easily manipulated, to the beauty of his religious institutions. It specifically associates Shaul, the founder of the Christian religion, with this whore. So to prepare everyone so that they are willing to engage in this battle and to speak against, I mean, talk about the consternation, the public humiliation, the personal attacks that accompany someone who does what God does and says that Paul, the author of half the Christian New Testament, was in fact demon-possessed. That he was insane, that he was a complete and utter fraud, that he was a false apostle, and that he was not a prophet, that he not only didn't speak for God, he spoke against God. Now, if you turn back the clock, this all began for me when 19 Muslims flew planes into the World Trade Center, buildings that I had been on the top floor of the World Trade Center. I had been asked to give a keynote speech to a large gathering of businessmen and women on the top floor of the World Trade Center. I knew the buildings well. They flew planes, two into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center, and they flew another into the Pentagon. And these 19 men who had hijacked one other plane trying to act as suicide bombers to fly that into the Capitol, but they were stopped from doing so. Screaming Allahu Akbar, killed 3,000 people. And so I, like all Americans, was wondering, what in the world happened? Who did this and why? Well, let me tell this story so that you have a sense of context and place, and you'll understand how I came to write not only Tea with Terrorists and Prophet of Doom, but Yada Yah, Introduction to God, Questioning Paul, and now Observations for Our Time. According to God, political and religious institutions are counterproductive, consistently failing to deliver on their promises of security and salvation, much less well-being and prosperity. But what is the alternative? What is Yahweh offering those who reject man's propositions? Where does God's advice and guidance actually lead? What is the right way? In what seems like a lifetime ago, although it was just a fraction of that at 15 years, God answered this question for me. And for the first time, I'm going to share his response with those of you who may be interested. I didn't actually know Yahweh when this occurred. But that was only from my limited perspective, stuck as I was in the ordinary flow of time. Akin to light and in the seventh dimension, Yahweh is able to witness all time at any time in the three-dimensional realm he created for us. So he knew how I would respond to his introduction. Having seen my future, he realized that I wouldn't be satisfied with a brief exchange or a snippet from the lyrics, David, whom I now know as Dod, meaning beloved, was inspired to write for this particular occasion. More importantly, God knew that I would invest the time required to know him, that I'd relationally consider the evidence which he had provided on our behalf, and that I'd be willing to go where his words led, even if everything I believed was torn asunder by them. Fellas, I think that is the single most important and difficult aspect, maybe aspects of all of this for most people. Are you willing to invest the time, and are you willing to go where the words lead? And you would think that more people would be willing to do both, when it's obvious that our world's coming to a screeching halt, that it's deteriorating at an extraordinarily rapid pace. I don't care which country you're in, whether it's Europe and you're inundated now with millions of Muslims and bankrupt countries, or you're in the United States. And I mean, can you imagine thinking that there's hope with a gaggle of clowns that are running for president of the United States?
You can't even, the seas are just about dead.
I don't even think I can lie to myself and believe there's hope.
No. Everybody knows this problem.
Yeah, we have done almost everything we can to destroy this planet. We've polluted it. We've covered it in blood. We have lied to everyone. Almost everything that almost anybody in any position of power is doing is now is deceitful and counterproductive. The world's coming to a crashing halt, and it's really going to be ugly over the next 15 years. So, you would think more people would be interested in a way out, in hope. And, you know, they can't find it in religion, because if you actually spend any time thinking about what the religious texts say, it's laughable. I mean, it's absolutely impossible that the Quran is true. It's a pathetic hoax. Horribly written, as are all of Paul's letters in the Christian New Testament. They are so obviously fraudulent that if you spend any time and you go where the words lead, you're going to abandon religious faith. And if you listen to any politician and then you witness what they have actually done, you'll realize they're totally, completely hypocrites, not worth your allegiance, your vote, your money, your trust. So you'd think people would be spending some time right now if the creator of the universe actually proved his existence, demonstrated that he authored the Torah, prophets, and Psalms for your consideration, and was providing an answer. You'd think you would at least invest the time to consider what he had to say.
Gosh, that could be the most important thing in your life.
You would think so. And you would think that even if, maybe even especially if, God's testimony differed from what you had been led to believe, that given the choice between one or the other, since you can never have both, they're in absolute conflict with each other, religion and the relationship God has envisioned for us, that you choose God over man. I mean, how smart do you have to be to know that God knows a little bit more than does man? God's a little better than is man. God's considerably more trustworthy than is man. Why wouldn't you go where his testimony leads, even if it leads you away from religion?
Strange.
Yeah. One September day, the 18th of September in 2001. I didn't know it at the time, but it was Teruah. The year was 5968 Yah. The set-apart spirit approached me, and I heard God's voice resonating, asking, but not demanding, if I would be willing to engage in an admittedly dangerous mission that would garner enormous animosity. This was not some sort of distinguishing honor, mind you. It was not some kind of reward or even an acknowledgement that I was somehow qualified to do something others couldn't. It was simply that no one else was willing. And truth be known, I wasn't either. The mission was to fulfill the purpose of Teruah, to shout out a warning, sounding the alarm that Islam was deceitful, that it was destructive, that it was deadly, and most assuredly, demonic and damning. Those who had done so before, just nibbling around the edges of the world's second and most, the second most popular religion, but without Yahweh's involvement, had become marked men, living under aliases and hiding, many hunted down and many killed. Under the circumstances and recognizing that I wasn't qualified, I did something very few people would even consider. I negotiated with God. At the time, I had an aversion to authority. I still do. And as I shared, I didn't know Yahweh. So while I was cautious and concerned, I wasn't the least bit intimidated by God, and most certainly not by Muslims. I told the voice that was well enough inside me that I would engage so long as the following three conditions were acceptable. First, he was qualified and I was not. Since he knew exactly what he wanted the world to hear and I did not, we would have to work together. I would not do any of this alone, reliant on my own abilities. Second, as an assurance that I would never retreat into my comfort zone, which was marketing, I insisted that God accept full responsibility for doing the one thing I felt I could achieve independently. So long as I was willing to talk to anyone at any time, he would promote the message by arranging the interviews. And third, since Muslims had a propensity to terrorize anyone who dared explain the reasons behind Islamic terrorism, I asked Yahweh to protect my family, making my home a safe sanctuary. Well, I did not know his name at the time. Yahweh agreed, saying that he'd have it no other way. After all, he wanted to do what I asked to have done. Now, that's a lesson learned. Then, as confirmation, he asked me to read the note that was in my right-hand pocket. It was a copy of the 91st Psalm. Its promises filled me with a level of confidence and courage I had never before experienced. Within weeks of that time, I found myself in the West Bank, in a subterranean room surrounded by Islamic terrorists. three of whom the previous evening had murdered 12 Jewish men and children on the road to Emmanuel. Having done so, equipped with weapons provided by the United States Marines. A pro-military, patriotic American at the time, my world was being rocked, but that was nothing compared to what was to come next. Muslims claiming an affiliation with the world's most infamous terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda, quoted Muhammad and his Quran to justify their acts of terrorism, claiming that their God, Allah, had imposed jihad upon all Muslims as a religious obligation. Could it be true? Had Islam corrupted these terrorists? Had the religion made them mass murderers? Or were the Western politicians and media correct in saying that these isolated individuals were radicals and extremists who had corrupted their religion to justify some of the most heinous acts the world has ever witnessed? The answer was obviously in the Quran and in the words and deeds of Muhammad as they were chronicled in the Hadith. The evidence therein would prove conclusively one way or the other whether these Islamic terrorists had cherry-picked a score of quotations, removing them from their context only to misinterpret each to support their terrorist acts. Was jihad a spiritual struggle, as so many were insisting? Or was Allah demanding armed attacks against defenseless civilians? Could everyone in the public arena be wrong? Was terrorism actually required of Muslims, as these men had insisted? I did the only rational thing. I acquired several translations of the Quran and the earliest, most credible sources of Hadith. I was aghast at the words parading before my eyes. It was all somehow familiar with what appeared to be Bible references, albeit out of context, jumbled and twisted together in a story so incredulous. I was not only disgusted by it, feeling dirty reading such rubbish, I couldn't help but wonder why so many people believed this immoral, inconsistent, literally insane diatribe was from God. Allah most assuredly bore no resemblance whatsoever to the God whose psalm we are about to read. If Yahweh was God, Allah was the adversary. They were opposites in every respect. One's message was the antithesis of the other. That much was obvious. It was in this way that I was introduced to the ploys of Satan and came to understand the religious strategies he inspires to masquerade as God. And while I do not recommend this approach to knowing God, by process of elimination, it resonated with me. For the first time in my life, I was beginning to understand the actual intent of religion. In the process, I embarked upon a remarkable journey, away from the religious and political myths that I had heretofore used to guide my steps. And along the way, both to satiate my curiosity and to maintain my sanity, I began to consider the testimony of the very God who had spoken to me on Teruah. What did he have to say for himself? The reason I have shared this personal experience is because I thought knowing how the 91st Psalm inspired me to provide some perspective into this relationship I have with God might be useful, and that the insights into the approach that I have used towards his testimony, then therefore to comprise these translations and write this supporting commentary, might also be helpful. But more than that, I hope what follows encourages others to boldly share Yahweh's purpose and plan while bluntly exposing the institutions which deserve our condemnation. quite frankly, all relationships are different. And while we all journey down the same path to Yah, we are unique individuals, bringing our own perspectives, attitudes, and experiences, even proclivities and interests to the relationship. This is not a competition. The more, the merrier. If everyone's relationship with Yah turns out to be better than my own, I'm not slighted. In fact, I'm happy for you and for him. And should my interaction with God be appealing to you, in the words which follow, you'll discover how it was conceived and developed, and what it has done for me, and what he has done for me, he'll do for you.
Can I make a comment on that quick?
Sure. In fact, I wrote that right after you sent me a letter.
Yeah. I was going to say those words sound familiar.
Yeah.
I talked to you, you know, a relationship with Yah is you same as your relationships with other people. My relationship with Craig is different than Kirk's relationship with Craig.
Mm-hmm.
Kirk and Craig are, I think Larry's the one I use as an example. Larry and Craig have a great relationship.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't change my relationship with Craig. It doesn't belittle my relationship with Craig.
Nope.
It doesn't change my relationship with Craig.
Nope.
It also doesn't change my relationship with Larry or Kirk.
Nope.
And it's
in fact, I would go so far as to say that the fact that I have a great relationship with Kirk and Larry might actually make your relationship with Kirk and Larry better. It might even enhance our relationship that we have friends in common.
Yeah, and the beauty of this is remember where it all started from.
Mm-hmm.
Yah only wanted one.
That's right.
He was going to walk with one guy.
He was satisfied with Adam alone.
And it was actually Adam that wanted more. And
yes.
He said, all right, you know, hey,
okay. I get it.
I can do that. You know, here you go. Now there's two.
And by the way, if I were Adam, I would have wanted the same thing, and I'm glad he wanted it. You know why? I am probably the least intimidated person alive as it relates to God. I still recognize the enormous disparity between the two of us. And if I was all that God had to enjoy and focus upon, I would be so dadgun intimidated, I'm so lacking that I'm not even sure I could handle it. But if I'm sharing God with my friends, and we're all in the same boat together, that I'm really comfortable with it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason, by the way, Scott, that you wrote me those words is that I started this off just as I have shared it today. I said, this is immensely personal with me. It's the first time I've ever written anything. And I've written what, I don't know how many, between the various volumes of the various books now, I know it's close to 20 books. And so I think it's 7,000 pages of material. I have always been self-depreciating. I will only introduce myself to say that I am irrelevant, flawed, and that you ought not trust me. I have no qualities that you would respect, should respect, in any possible way, that this story is not about me, it's about Yahweh. But with the 91st Psalm, it is about me. Now, it's about you, too, if you choose to claim its promises for yourself, because they were written for you as well as they were written for me. But the 91st Psalm, it is personal.
Well, and I told you when you said that you felt it was a little, you were wondering if you're being too personal.
Yeah.
I don't think you can be, especially when it's your relationship. You're not saying that you have to take everything that you're saying and that's the be-all, end-all. You're saying, this is what I see. This is my experience. And then you say, do your own translations.
Right.
You've never said
anything
other than that.
This is the 91st Psalm defines how my relationship with Yahweh began. It defines how we have worked together ever since. It defines our mission together. It defines our relationship. It defines his support. It is wholly and completely explanatory as it relates to my relationship with Yahweh, as it would be yours.